Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
From around the world, once again, I feel honored to be addressing all of you. You're on the cutting edge. Whether you've been a victim of psychiatric and psychological abuses, or whether you're a professor in your tower, your ivory tower, doing great research, you're there because you know the truth really matters. And I so appreciate all of you listening to the show. Don't forget my website, breggin.com, and my relatively new, just a month or two old, extensive adjunct to the website. You can find it on breggin.com. My Tardive Dyskinesia Resource Center, which is about how the antipsychotic drugs harm the brain of animals and human beings alike, producing not only tardive dyskinesia, but generalized brain damage. You'll find dozens and dozens, probably well over 150 scientific articles and other important resources on the Tardive Dyskinesia Resource Center on breggin.com. My guest today is my friend Michael Fontaine, PhD. Michael is at Cornell University. We didn't know each other before we got here. Michael is an associate professor of classics. He's also the associate dean of the faculty. And Michael had become very interested in the work of Thomas Szasz. And lo and behold, he discovered, or I discovered, or we discovered that we were both here in Ithaca. So we've gotten together. He's now published an amazing blog on Madness Network, on Madden America, that great website of Robert Whitaker's. And he has a blog on the website that begins, the title of it is, What Do the DSM, Elvis Presley, and Dionysus Have in Common? And the blog begins, to a classicist, parentheses, a professor of Greek and Latin like me, the psychotic illnesses detailed in the pages of DSM look like nothing but the main characters of the classical tragedies of ancient Greek, only born anew under medicalized names. You may remember from an earlier show where Michael talked about the earliest days, and I want to get back to that as well in today's discussion, the earliest days of classical literature in which the poets and dramatists of the time, several hundred years B.C. in Greece, were making fun of the psychiatrists who wanted to reduce everything to diagnoses, and believe it or not, even then, to medicines. So I just think his perspective brings something very, very special to all of our work and all of our understanding. And today he's going to be unleashed to talk more about the relationship between the classical descriptions of madness and the medical analysis of them. And it's Michael Fontaine, and he spells his last name F-O-N-T-A-I-N-E. Michael, I presume you're there. The engineer tells me you're there.
I'm here, Peter. It's good to talk to you again.
good to talk to you again. I think we have actually had lunch together with Ginger once, haven't we, since the last time you were on the show?
Yes, we have. That's right.
So we actually have a relationship in the real world as well as on the internet. I'm really glad of that. We all work so hard and have so, at least Ginger and I, and spend so little time with the people who matter to us. Tell us about your blog, the inspiration for it on Madden America, and I just want to unleash you on this subject.
Well, for sure. I'm happy to do that, and thanks again, Peter. So as I explain in the blog, I'm a professor of Greek and Latin, not just the language, but the literature that the ancient Greeks wrote. And this brings us back, as you said, about 2,500 years ago. And so if you had been a person in ancient Athens, let's say 2,400 years ago, you might have seen a particular tragedy called The Bacchae by Euripides. Now, Euripides is probably the greatest playwright of the ancient world. He was sort of like Shakespeare for the ancient audiences. And so everybody would go and watch one of these tragedies a couple times a year. They would go with their family members. And over the past summer, I was teaching a course here at Cornell for adult students on Greek tragedy, and I had ordered a copy of this book that had a picture of a young Elvis Presley on the cover. And I thought it was, as soon as we read the play, very obvious why Elvis was on the cover, but the students had a bit of a harder time seeing it right off the bat. So it gave us a lot of fodder for discussion. You know, Elvis was not really around all that long ago. But the analogy is very interesting. So I began this class, and I said to the students, people define Greek tragedies in many different ways, but here's a definition I'd like to propose, and it's this: that the playwright creates a situation in which there's a dispute and everyone is correct. So you have a conflict, usually a conflict that can't be resolved, and it involves different characters, and the playwright has to, the way a playwright does a good job is by giving everyone's perspective. And it's a very special genre of literature because the playwright has to help us understand why human beings behave the way they do. And in some of these tragedies, in particular the Bacchae and a few others, the character either goes mad or is said to go mad. Today we would say they are psychotic or undergo a psychotic break. And but they're never medicalized in the tragedies. So the playwrights try to understand on existential grounds why these characters will sometimes do these outrageous things, engage in these behaviors. But they always make it clear, and Euripides makes it very clear, that he considers these behaviors that the protagonists elect to participate in. These are things that they choose, basically. And so in the Bacchae, it's a very interesting play. It is the last play that Euripides ever wrote, and it is such a dangerous play that it wasn't even staged in his lifetime. His son produced it after he had died. And in the play, it shows the arrival of a charismatic young man to the town of Thebes, which is a city in Greece, and he has come to bring his new religion to town, and he's seeking converts, and he attracts, in particular, all the women of the city. They are flocking to see this guy, and when they get together, they are losing all control, and they are performing ecstatic religion. That is to say, they are shouting with glee and joy. They seem serenely happy to be around this man, and this is making some of the men in town extremely unhappy, in particular the civil authorities. And so there's a young king who decides he's going to stamp out these behaviors by arresting the charismatic young guy. So I asked the students, why do you think Elvis is on the cover of this thing? And of course they had no trouble connecting Elvis to the protagonist who drives young women crazy. And then, so I said, well, let's look at some of these clips. And I found a few and I put them on the blog post. And they're really extraordinary, if you were not there, as I was not, to watch groups of young women just absolutely losing control, tears streaming down their faces, like a religious revival, to watch Elvis shake his hips and sing his songs. And so I asked the students, some of whom had seen Elvis around that time, I said, why do you think women don't do that anymore? You don't really see them doing that so much. And that brought us... it gave us a very long discussion of, I said, you know, just looking from the outside, some of that behavior could easily be described as psychotic, except for the fact that these women are doing it in groups, which gives a little more protection. So I wonder what you think about that.
Oh, I'm just going to listen. I think this is fascinating. I hadn't even thought about the fact that you don't quite see that same level of hysteria. Also with the Beatles.
Exactly, yeah.
And I don't know enough of the history of music to remember when the Beatles came versus when Elvis came. But that is interesting. It was a much more conventional time.
Yes.
When you think of both the Beatles and Elvis coming on TV, on what was his name's show? Who was this really conventional man? Golly, you remember his name, I'm sure. But
was
he had
the Ed Sullivan. Yeah.
Yeah. What was it?
Sullivan. Was it the Sullivan?
Yeah, Ed
show?
Sullivan. Yeah, that's
Ed
right.
Sullivan.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Ed Sullivan in his suit, his very staid appearance, and. And he introduced both of those folks to America, I guess. And I hadn't really thought about all this and how mad and wild. And I think probably not so much anymore. We're in a different time. But you asked me the question. Do you have some kind of an answer?
Well, I think you're getting right around to my own thinking on this. I am very struck as I study the history of madness and the history of psychiatry in modern times. That so 120 years ago, hysteria was infecting women all around Vienna, all around Europe. Nobody knew what was going on. And you don't really see that anymore. You don't see women who are having these hysterical problems. But what we do see in our own time, and this is, I saw this in the New York Times not long ago, the New York Times said that in 2013, I'm going to quote this, one in 10 Americans now takes an antidepressant medication. And among women in their 40s and 50s, the figure is one in four. And so I am struck by the fact that we don't really have hysteria anymore, but we do have depression, especially among women, according to the New York Times. And so your thinking is right in line with my own. That was a much more conservative time, and it strikes me that in conservative times, women were eager to, or are attempting to express their individuality, to express their longing for some autonomy, some freedom, and having a difficult time to do it. And so it manifested its way in these group behaviors where it's maybe a little safer in the group to cut loose and scream and holler and have a good time. And
not just autonomy and freedom. I mean, we have to more openly acknowledge that a lot of this was about also the ability to express sexual passion.
Absolutely, yes.
And very young girls in the with the the rock stars, but in the play, how old are the? Do we have an idea of how old the women are in the play?
We do, and it's really nice that you drew that out. I should have thought about that myself, but it's exactly the sexuality of the women in the play is very much at hand, and it's not just, it seems to be women of all ages, but in particular, the young king who's angry and wants to get rid of this stranger who's driving the women crazy, his own mother has decided to take off and follow the stranger. So given the fictions of when women gave birth at the time, she would have been a woman in her 30s, let us say. But also, the situation is even more analogous because in ancient Greece, even in famous Athens, which we always think of as this great place for freedom and democracy, the women were sequestered. They were kept inside the house. They were expected to not go outdoors without a chaperone, a male chaperone. And they had very, very little freedom of any kind of expression, certainly not for sexuality. And so it's very interesting that these freedoms for women to express themselves, to express their sexuality, to have some control over that, as those have expanded, psychosis, or you might say hysteria, has gone away, and depression is on the rise. And so I am just wondering, and I ask you, and maybe I'm asking your listeners if they have insights on this, does unhappiness go hand in hand with freedom? Because now that you are free to express yourself, you're also expected to stand on your own two feet or to live with consequences of choices. That makes people unhappy.
That's very existential. My mind is not quite there yet. I'm thinking about how very often when people rise out of depression by going into what gets diagnosed as mania, that is when they become euphoric and high and seemingly happy, although the quality of the experience is rarely what we would call happiness and usually ends up being quite painful and very, very uncomfortable for the person because it ends up feeling very out of control. But that is very often involves sexuality. So you go from the whole suppression of one's spirit, in which there is usually a lack of spirituality, sexuality, passion, to mania, which is when not ritualized is called mania, and often has the same kind of sexual component, but it's isolated. Mania is an isolated expression of what we're seeing, in this case, looking just at women. I hadn't expected at all to go in this direction. What we saw so much in the young girls in the beginning of rock and roll, and also that you're talking about, going back to Euripides. And I don't think drugs were very much involved in the beginning with the Beatles, or with Elvis. This is not the 60s or later 60s rock band kind of experience with all the folks flooding upstate New York, you know, for that great coming together, not so far from where I live. This is something more of the conservative people breaking out.
Yes.
Hadn't thought about any of this. I wish I had more knowledge, more historical data at my fingertips, but that was a conservative breaking out of these youngsters, and probably even in the audiences on the TV show, if we go back and look. And so remember with the Beatles coming to America, how much of that was going on. So we're talking about the difference between, in part, between a ritualized, in the case of the Euripides, a ritualized breaking out of women, in that case of more of all ages, from enormous social constraints. From what you're saying, I know very little about that, the social life at that time. And then we see something very similar with Elvis and the Beatles. I think it is very interesting. I'm going to give it back to you. I've run out.
Well, I think if your audience were looking for one particular quick read to see what the sort of things we're talking about, I would love to recommend this play to them. They could read it in 90 minutes and talk about it with their friends, especially if they've gone through some of these issues. But that is... everything you said, I think, is more or less on point. You've got a deeply conservative society, and I think you're right that the drugs had not come in the time of Elvis and the Beatles. That stuff is later. But you've got a society that's invested in controlling women's freedoms and bodies and expression. And, you know, it reminds me of a line from the poet Horace. Horace wrote about 2,000 years ago in the Roman Empire, and he famously said, "You can drive out human nature with a pitchfork, but she always finds her way back in." And so I think what he meant by that is that, you know, you can try and control how other people behave and force them, you know, to, say, sit in a classroom all day long or to only marry certain individuals or something. But their individuality is longing to come out so badly that it sometimes comes out in ways that the average person is unfamiliar with or disturbed by, or, you know, it can come out as psychosis. And sometimes that's a voluntary thing, as it seems to be with Elvis. Now, in the play, it's interesting that this, it's cast in a specifically religious context, that this charismatic young person seems to be someone who's going to come and convert these women to a new way of looking at the world, and that seems to be what really frightens the authorities. The women stop doing their work, they take off to go to the mountains, And it's very interesting you brought up sexuality, because one of the rumors in the play is that the women are engaging in non-traditional sexual behaviors in the mountains, that they've gone out to this mountain outside the city, and they are having orgies of various kinds, either with each other or with other men, it's not clear, but that they are doing all kinds of terrible things. So the young authority, the young king, decides to go out there and take a look at all this. And he gets out there and he finds out that the rumors were all wrong. The women are, when he arrives, very much in a tranquil state. They've been sleeping. But they do catch him. They wake up and they catch him spying on them. And they enter what I suppose today we would call a manic episode, and they get violent with him. They do enter this, I'm not sure you would call it a joyous state, but we would say a frenzy or a fury, and they see him, and the play ends. What makes it a tragedy is that the women catch sight of him, and they tear him apart with their bare hands. And that seems to be a metaphor for all kinds of things, for spying, for the mania itself, perhaps for the religious aspects of the new cult. But it when you were speaking about mania coming in episodes as a sort of gleeful response or reaction that doesn't make the individual happy. I was struck by that. I wasn't aware of that. Could you say a little more? When somebody comes out of depression into one of these episodes, what's the typical sort of response that you've seen?
Yes, I will. Before doing that, I just did a little noodling around on the internet. And the Beatles, of course, are early 60s. And Elvis comes out really in 1954 to 56. 1956 is Love Me Tender, which was an amazing ballad. And the Beatles' Love Me Do, which we probably all remember, was 1962. That's 12. That's only 6 years later. So they're fairly close together, but clearly the groundbreaking is Elvis. I'm just finding this really interesting. How old is the king? Is the one they tear apart, the young king?
Yeah, there's some other, exactly. There's some interesting aspects to him as well.
How old is he?
He seems to be, say, 16, 17, 18, something
like
that.
Oh, my Lord, how interesting.
And what's also interesting is that when he goes to spy on the women, he is persuaded to dress up as a woman to go watch. And so Euripides is playing around with some aspects. He seems to be a young man uncertain of his own sexuality. He thinks it's ridiculous that he would dress up as a woman, although he ultimately comes to do it. And so it's a very rich play from many different points of view.
How old is Euripides when he writes this?
Let's see. I'd have to do the math. I think he was about, I'm trying to calculate BC years backwards. Let's call him 70 years old, more or less.
I see. He had a long, good life there in those days.
Very good. Yeah. He was a very successful tragedian.
Well, you know, when in therapy, and of course human beings, first of all, I want to say human beings vary in everything they experience, including what we call getting depressed and what we call getting high or manic. But a not unusual situation would be that an individual has been dealing with a lot of depression, and then they begin to show element of getting high. If they're in therapy, they may talk about being happy, being successful, that they've just done something really amazing, that they're they've got this fabulous business idea and they know it's going to make them rich and it's going to happen in a matter of months, or they've just bought this amazing car and they may have done it. They may have spent all their money buying a car. And in the beginning, it feels good. And if you talk with that person in therapy and you've got a trusting relationship and you say to them, well, this looks pretty risky to me, tell me some more. You know, I'm not feeling so great and comfortable as we're talking about this. I'm a little concerned about what's going on with you. They might say, well, I'm not going back to being depressed. Mm-hmm. So you get that element of choice. Does that mean they chose to go into the state? I'm not at all sure that there's any kind of conscious choice. I actually don't know. in all my years, I still can't understand necessarily, even in my own life, where an emotion overcomes and then a choice gets involved, or where a choice leads to emotion. Life is just not that clear cut to me. But the person will actually, at that point, might say to you, I can't bear it. I'm not going back to being depressed. But then, since I don't give drugs to anybody, I can actually talk to them through this whole process. And then they might get to a point where it's now extremely uncomfortable. They're not sleeping. They're over-energized. They go from feeling at times that this is being happy and they never go back to feeling at times that this is exhausting, out of control, and they're starting to have negative feelings they don't like. Many people get very hostile and aggressive, exactly as is portrayed in the group. You know, they don't get violent usually, but, you know, they make it very aggressive and angry. They often do something of a minor violent nature. They get some hospitalized, for example. They may, you know, hit a family member or get into an altercation, even with the police. They don't usually tear anybody apart, obviously. But the pattern goes from a feeling of happiness and elation to getting out of control. And they may even turn to drugs or alcohol to try to control it because it's scary and feels like a bad place. At the same time, they may feel, or it's very, can be very compounded in different ways. They may feel like they're God or have a special relationship to God during this period of time. I have worked with people who actually have been able to go through a good part of that process with me without medication. But that would be a very unusual and special human being who could do that. Most people, if they get into the really manic end, they just end up in trouble and involuntarily hospitalized, where they get drugged down. In the old days, a couple hundred years ago, where we had safe havens, people, from all we can tell, would go through this process without drugs, maybe just a glass or two of wine, but a lot of caretaking and a lot of support, a lot of moralizing, a lot of religious moralizing to help them in Quaker retreats, like the Took retreats late 1700s in Great Britain. So I'm sort of rambling around it, back to you, because this is not going to be something where I come out with these conclusions.
No, what I think is fascinating, it really is fascinating. I'm thinking, of course, as you're describing all this, of individuals I've known over the course of my life that have mimicked, they have done exactly everything you've described. It makes me wonder whether the economy goes boom and bust because millions of people are doing exactly the same thing you just described, from optimism to depression. But in particular, you've described the plot line of Euripides' play, The Bacchae, even better than I think we had realized. I had never thought about it as sort of a boom-bust approach, or bust-boom, I guess. But what's interesting, so I'll give you maybe in your listeners a quiz. You know, every god in ancient Greece was the god of something. Do you know what Dionysus, so Zeus is the god of the lightning bolt, and Hera, his wife, is the god of marriage and various things. Do you know what Dionysus is the god of?
Oh, I'm embarrassed. I don't want to guess.
No, you shouldn't be, because he's one of the rarest. He is probably one of the rarest of the gods. But he was the god, first, of theater, but more importantly, the god of wine.
Of what? Of wine.
Of wine.
And lying. So theater and
no,
lying.
No. Wine. That you red
w.
wine, white wine. That
white,
kind of
red
wine.
And white wine. Good.
Well,
wine. It's very clear. No, I did not have the faintest idea.
No, that's okay. And it's an important dimension of the play, because part of the worship of this new god in the play is supposed to be that you're drinking wine. And so these women are drinking wine as part of the cycle that they're going through, from elation to depression, back to this terrifying sort of aggressive, I wouldn't say... I guess rapture might be the best word, because it doesn't sound like a happy elevation from depression, but simply this lifting yourself out of the sadness by partaking in this aggressive stance. But they do, they are drinking wine as part of that. And as you said, people in these in this condition will sometimes turn to drugs or alcohol to cope, or you know, when they're going through these cycles in life like that. Very interesting. So I, you know, there are a couple other examples about this in Greek literature. I thought I'd just run a couple of them by you. One, there's a play by, it's probably the most famous Greek tragedy of all, is Sophocles' play Oedipus the King, or Oedipus Rex, as it's sometimes called. Everybody knows the story of Oedipus because he kills his father and marries his mother. But in this particular play by Sophocles, it seems to be the first example of road rage that you're ever going to find in Western literature. So that play is even older than the Bacchae. But in it, Oedipus explains that he's killed this man, which it turns out is he thinks is his father, because he gets into a traffic accident at where these roads meet, and he gets out and he loses his temper, and he just completely loses who he is, and he beats this man and a couple other people to death. And so I was, as I was reading this play with some students not long ago, I was Googling around. I said, I wonder if road rage is a DSM diagnosis. And it turns out that it is, or is something like that. There's a name for it. But this idea that you, it is called, let me see if I can find the thing here. What was the one that it came up with? Intermittent explosive disorder, which struck me as basically another example of psychosis, right? That is to say, you are so blinded by anger that you do the kind of, I mean, you get out of your car and you begin screaming uncontrollably at some other person who's just like you. You may get violent at the person. This is when these cases make the news. And so there seems to be another example of this kind of thing in Greek tragedy where you have somebody engaging in this kind of behavior, but we don't medicalize that kind of response. You know, the playwrights work, and we don't, you know, we would not administer drugs to deal with that kind of thing. It looks like, just to judge from the DSM, that it is now considered sort of a disorder, or, you know, a psychiatric disorder. And so treatment, they recommend, I was interested in this, not just cognitive behavioral therapy, but also psychotropic medication. Even though it says the pharmaceutical options have shown limited success. So,
that's never bothered us in psychiatry.
Well, it's incredible. That is to say, I don't think it would have occurred to Sophocles when he's writing this play that this was a mental illness or that this was a medical matter whatsoever. It would have been a human matter. This even shows up in our language. We used to call it madness because people get mad. They get angry. But that, I think the link between those two ideas of madness and being angry has sort of disappeared or is getting harder to see. And there's a few more of these. I mean, really extraordinary. I was interested very much in the situation of women when we were doing this class over the summer. And there's another tragedy. This is another great one for people to read. Only takes about 90 minutes. It's called Medea by Euripides. And the play that Euripides takes is about this young woman, not young, she's a mother, an immigrant woman, is moved to Greece with her husband, Jason, who is a guy who's kind of past his prime. And in his older days, he was this great heroic guy, and she had stood loyally by his side and had helped him out of some scrapes and various things. And now the play is takes place with them reaching middle age. This guy, Jason, is now after a younger woman. He doesn't seem to have any meaningful work or anything like that. And so the story is about Medea going from being a loving mother and a loving wife to being so infuriated by her husband ignoring her and going after another woman that she ends up in the play killing her own children, which, again, is the sort of, you know, we read headlines about this periodically. Typically, when a mother does that kind of thing, the behavior is medicalized, or let's say pathologized. It's considered to be symptomatic of a mental illness of some kind. But Euripides, I think, would not have really understood that kind of response. He wouldn't have thought that a medical intervention was likely to cure it, although it would certainly stop the manic behavior on a short-term thing. So this, I'm toying, frankly, with writing a book about some of this stuff, the parallels between Greek mythology and the diagnoses in the DSM, and say, folks, what is it that we're describing here? We're all looking at the same behaviors or groups of behaviors that disturb other people. They disturb us, ourselves, if they happen to us or we engage in them. But we are attributing different origins to them. And just because we live much later and we have iPhones and we have air conditioners and airplanes and that sort of thing, I'm not so sure that we understand the human condition better now than other people at other times may have understood it. This is sort of some of the thoughts I'm having these days.
Well, this is so interesting. Are there a lot of examples in ancient writing, classical writing, that shows a tremendous awareness of the frustration of women in their social roles?
There is. And Euripides himself is probably the most prominent voice for that. And Euripides has been called both the first feminist and the first misogynist. And it's interesting to see how people come around to that point of view, because they say, well, Euripides, for example, he writes this play, Medea, and the main speaker is a woman, and she gets by far the majority of the lines. We are meant to sympathize with her up until the horrific last moment. And so people say, well, he is a feminist because he wants... it seems like Euripides thinks we should grant greater freedoms to women in our society, that they have aspirations to live their own lives, perhaps independent from men, or independent from others, just to live their own lives. And yet, it's a tragedy, so the play ends with a woman who's a great exemplar of trying to do that sort of thing, killing her own kids.
So we've got two of his plays where women end up killing the man in power.
That's right. And so one thing to understand with Greek tragedy, by definition, a Greek tragedy ends with somebody being killed. So that has to happen more or less.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to happen with this.
No.
The consistency of just those two plays. That's so interesting.
Oh, fascinating. And there are some others. I think Euripides does seem to have been deeply disturbed by women being sequestered in the house. Again, it's not totally different from what we see in some societies around the world today. And this is in Athens, the place that's famous for democracy and philosophy.
Right.
The women had to veil their hair. They, some of them, it looks like, covered their faces when they went out in public. As I said before, they had chaperones to go outdoors. They could not inherit property. They were always under the control of some man. And Euripides seemed to have been troubled by that.
Did Euripides write anything in straight prose that would give us an insight into his just his plain rational observations on something like women?
No, he didn't. And I think he would have laughed if you asked him to do that. I say laugh because he would say, you need to read the plays and think for yourself, and it'll all be clear. The amazing thing about the tragedies, the reason they're so fascinating to read and to discuss with your friends, is that you can take everyone's point, you can take any point of view and sympathize with virtually everybody in the play. And, you know, for him to simply say that we are going to, if he had written a treatise, I'm trying to think, is there anything even like that in the ancient world, from Greece or Rome, in prose about the status of women? And I think the answer must be no.
Wow.
No, it's really quite extraordinary. You don't get anything like that, really, until the Enlightenment, which is in the 1700s AD. So that is, say, thousands
of years. You know, there's a thought going on in the back of my mind about, this is a bit far away, Thomas Jefferson and his view of slaves. And, of course, there's a lot of evidence that he had a relationship, that is, he would have to be looked at as using his slave, Sally. And he, at one point, and he never frees his slaves in his lifetime, or even, unlike George Washington, even on his death, Washington frees the slaves on his wife's death and frees the slave who's closest to him. But he writes, Jefferson writes at one point, that he fears and anticipates that the slaves at some point will rise up. And he fears, and it sounds like feels guilty, because he's saying that he thinks God will side with them and not with the slaveholders. And that occurred to me as you're describing these women rising up and killing their oppressors.
That is what the Bacchae is about. I think you're right. You know, Jefferson is a real conundrum. I'm no expert in Jefferson, but I agree with what you say. Here is one of the founding fathers of Enlightenment thought, of constitutional freedom, who doesn't free slaves. I mean, it's really extraordinary.
And apparently, you know, uses and takes advantage of a young girl.
And this is certainly not to agree with this point of view, and it's just really to speculate, but I think certain individuals have had it over time, is to say that letting these people, setting them free, will make them unhappy. And this is sort of the thought I had at the beginning, right, where we now, women in the United States today have the same constitutional freedoms that men have, which is not to say, that is say, under law they do, although in practice it's not equal. And that doesn't necessarily make, in the aggregate, it looks like, a lot of American women happy if one in four of them are taking antidepressants.
Right.
And so if Jefferson had the idea that not setting a human being free would keep that person happier, well, I'm certainly not going to agree with that. But it might be the thought that he had.
Well, you know, it certainly was a common thought that the slaves were better off enslaved. It was a part of their nature and so on. But I don't believe that either Jefferson or Washington ever voiced that. It's so interesting. You know, I wrote a little book about American history, as you know, while I'm an American, and that's really got me thinking. It's about using the principles of the founders, but not always their behaviors, as a blueprint for leading a good life, using the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and other documents and thoughts as a model for how to pursue your life as an independent human being. It just so touches on the depth of conflict that has always just embroiled our cultures and our societies going way, way back. I don't think there was a halcyon period in which human beings lived in peace. And a lot of people would like to think that maybe before civilization, before villages and towns in 10,000 BC, human beings lived a life more conflict-free, but I doubt it. And it's so interesting to go back to the earliest writings and see the depth of the conflict, the depth of the despair, the depth of the anguish, the depth of the violence. It's quite stunning for me to be thinking about it with you on this show. And that this is what life has been like. And this is what we human beings must contend with, including the perpetual injustice that is always upon us everywhere. Wow.
It's very difficult it's a sobering thought to think back on the record of conflict. But you're right. It's the 500th anniversary right now of Thomas More's book, Utopia. You know, this mystical island where life is easy. There's not really any examples of that. But what I have been talking about a lot lately with classes here and with other people around town is the status of women. The freedoms of women have not been with us very long. So, as you know, I study the ancient world. That usually takes me back about 25 centuries. 25 centuries to about 20 centuries ago. And women have had the right to vote in the United States for, 100 years, give or take. That's it, 100 years. And it's so recent, and it is such a frail freedom. You don't see it everywhere around the world, that it is, it's easy to take that for granted. And there just don't seem to be any automatic fixes, right? For social problems, there's no magic button that's going to make conflict go away. It's a shame, but I, you know, we keep trying to find ways of expanding freedom and making people happy, but that takes us straight into personal politics. And as I'm sure you know, people take many different views on how to solve social problems.
Right. And in addition to the issues of the, how free are women, they're certainly vastly more free now than they were even a decade or two ago. But there's this horrible dark underside of how many women are abused in their marriages and can't find a way out, how many children are abused, often by the male of the family, but not always. And then this horrible dark underside of the slave trade, the sexual slave trade of children, which of course involves boys as well as girls. It's let's go back to Euripides somehow.
Could talk a bit more about the tragedies.
Yeah, I would really like to just get as much to just mine that wisdom, that incredible view, as well as Medea, of men dominating the society, which is, I'm sure, viewed itself as being the epitome of the development of the human being to its highest point ever. And they're living on some level in terror of their women. How about their slaves? Is there much going on in those days about concern about slaves? And where was slavery in those societies?
It's a good question. So in Greece and Rome both, they had slavery on the same model that we had it here in the United States, which is, everybody had slaves in the ancient world. The abolition of slavery is a very, very recent, relatively speaking, development in human history. The United States was among the last of places to abolish slavery, but even then, that was just 151 years ago, so not very long. But in Greece and Rome, they had the same kind of slavery we had in the U.S., which is chattel slavery, where you break up the families and you sell them off. And that is generally considered the most inhumane model of slavery, granting that all slavery is inhumane. So they had that. We don't see a lot of evidence in the tragedies for any sympathy for slaves. There is a comedy, and I'm glad you brought this up. There is a comedy by this guy, Plautus, who's a Roman writer. I've mentioned him before because he is the one who has the famous play that you and I have talked about before, the Menaechmi, about the Menaechmus brothers, where the guy is declared insane and a psychiatrist shows up and attempts to prescribe drugs for him to be given forcibly. So he has another play, and this takes place in Rome, probably about 200 years after Euripides' Bacchae, but it's based on a Greek play from around the same time. And in it, he does give us the voices of slaves talking. And there's one particular slave who says to another slave, you better fall in line because we're slaves now. We'd all rather be free, but that's not much of a choice. And it seems like a revolutionary thing to put into the mouth of a character on stage, but it's just about the only thing you can point to where there's any real regard for human beings who are in captivity like that.
Yeah.
The Greek tragedians are much more focused, I think, on struggles of their own within their own societies of social equals. But you bring up a good point that these men in Greece were terrified of women. I think they really were. As you say, when you're in charge, that probably seems like the natural order of things. That's just the way things ought to be. But you have Euripides, and there's the comedian Aristophanes, who was a contemporary of Euripides. He wrote comedies at the same time Euripides was doing tragedies, and he has a couple of them which try to give voice to women for expanding their own freedoms as well. And so, you know, in we have, about 33 Greek tragedies. We have 11 of these comedies from Aristophanes. There's like 44 of these plays, each one trying to show us a segment of life. I thought I'd mention one more of them to you since we're talking about some of these struggles. The most famous example of psychosis in the ancient world was the legendary figure of Heracles. We call him Hercules sometimes in English, but it's the same character. And Euripides has another play. It's called Heracles. in which he's the protagonist, and he is a soldier who has come home from performing all these struggles, these labors abroad, and he goes into a fit of madness, and in this fit of madness, he shoots his wife and he shoots his kids, and he shoots them with arrows rather than a gun, but again, it's the kind of character that unfortunately we read about every now and then in the newspaper. Someone whose struggle has just totally overwhelmed them. But the interesting thing here is that Euripides creates a character named Madness, and it's meant to be a sort of an abstraction of this god or goddess. It's a goddess named Madness. Her name is Lyssa in Greek. And she climbs onto the rooftop, and she says in the middle of the play, I'm going to go down into Heracles' house and drive him mad so that he does these. And so the rest of that play is a meditation on whether these behaviors are caused by, we would say today, our brains, or they're caused by God, or whether they are things that we are electing and we're choosing somehow, however consciously we're doing that kind of thing. So that's one where I think you might really enjoy reading and discussing with some people as well.
In that play, do we, that we have the richness in Heracles' life that would give that you get in some other of the plays where you get a sense of why he ends up like that other than just the god made him do it?
Well, so that's a good question. I don't personally think it's one of his better tragedies. And for that very reason, we're not given as much of a background story to help us sympathize. But what's strange about the play is that the character, Madness, comes on stage and says, I'm going to go strike him mad, and he's going to do these things. But then, after he has killed his family, the remainder of the play is taken up with different characters asking him why he did it. And Heracles himself says, I don't believe the gods really cause us to do these things. That's a lie told by the poets. So Heracles himself, and Euripides seems to have been probably an atheist himself, or at least someone who thought the gods were indifferent to what human beings do to each other. So he seems to be toying with this idea of an expression sort of like we have in English where we say, the devil made me do it. That's a metaphor, I think, for most people today when they use that expression, although not for everyone. But the question really is, are we doing these things freely, or is something causing us to do that? And that seems to be the big divide of that play. So he's looking at it there, not so much from the medical point of view.
So we get no sense in that play of why what his family may have done or other people may have done. Meaning in the play about the women, you know, the king is trying to suppress them,
yeah.
The young king. And so we have a real genuine cultural, political conflict going on to suppress the women metaphorically in the play or really. And they strike back in this violent way. By the way, what happens to the women after they do that in the play?
Believe it or not, the play breaks, the manuscript that we have breaks off at the very, very end, at one of the most interesting sections. But the women sort of come to their senses, and the play ends with a long lament, saying, I can't believe we did these things. What were we thinking? This is an awful tragedy. And it just sort of ends with their ritual lament. In Greece, the women were... they had more specific rituals of mourning the death of someone than most of us have here in the United States today. So that's sort of it.
They're not punished.
No, there's no sense of the aftermath of what's going to happen next. No. It leaves things completely uncertain at the end. In Heracles' case, or Heracles' case, I think there Euripides is more interested in the kind of situation we see, for example, with a veteran who goes abroad and comes home having seen war or, you know, killed enemy combatants or been exposed to terrifying situations, and it cannot integrate back into society. And so his wife and children in the play seem to be completely innocent victims, people who are simply his family members trying to live with him. And so there Euripides seems to be questioning, it's not as clear as he would like, but maybe questioning what it means to put an individual under extreme stress and then try to come home again. So more familiar with what today I think people tend to call PTSD. You know, how an individual copes with that kind of trauma.
In the Bakai, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, is there any discussion or voicing of what of the women having a complaint or an argument with the culture, with the men?
That's a good question. In the Bakai, do they? No. In other plays, in Medea, yes. In Medea, there are some spectacular speeches by Medea herself, saying all the points that they are completely feminist now. In the Bacchae, no. So they say nothing until the very end. They're not given individual voices. So for the kind of insights you're looking at, Medea is the place to go. And she says these things. We women are not given the same. In Medea, she says, we women are not given the same freedoms that you men have. Men can run off and do whatever they want. We are expected to be at home, loving wives, caring for children. If a woman screws up, people are extremely unforgiving. They're very judgmental of her. And what's interesting in her case as well is that she's a foreigner. So she's an immigrant trying to be accepted by the larger community. And the play makes it clear that she's not welcome.
Do we have any idea about how Greek audiences responded to that incredible play?
All we have are stories that are probably not true. That is to say, they're written down very, very long after it. So, no. The only thing we can say is that after Euripides died, he became seen immediately as a great playwright. He became seen as one of the three Shakespeares of ancient Greece. So that tells us something, not so much about the immediate audience, but about the audience forever after. So the Medea and the Bacchae and some of these other plays became instant classics. And if you were learning Greek in an ancient school, you would have studied these plays. The same way today people might read Hamlet in school, or they might read Julius Caesar.
So they would have been confronted in school with these issues in a way in which in schools today we don't confront these issues.
It's true, isn't it? That's a good point. It's not until we get to college. So one of the great pleasures of my life here at Cornell is that I get students show up in the classroom and I say, I've got limited time with you folks. We're only going to read the best. And so I try to bring these things in and I say, I know you're here to be engineers or you're here to, to go off and have meaningful careers as architects or whatever. But I've got you.
Yeah.
So let's read and think.
Michael, we're coming to an end. And I haven't even but once mentioned your name, Michael Fontaine. Fontaine. You can find his blog on Mad in America. Hey, very, very interesting hour together. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.